Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we feature a conversation with Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill. Last week, Gill released his determination that a recent police shooting in Salt Lake City was legally justified. The shooting death of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal has been the focus of protests in recent weeks, and activists are not satisfied with the DA's decision not to charge officers. Today, we talked to Gill about that specific case and about the changes he's recommending to the laws that govern when and how an officer might be held accountable after using deadly force. I spoke to the district attorney yesterday. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, thank you very much for being here.
Absolutely.
Last week, you determined that the shooting death by police of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal was legally justified, and I won't have you walk us through that decision in detail. Again, I will say that he was fleeing from police at the time of his death. He had a gun. To distill your decision down, police had a reasonable fear that he would harm them or others, and the law says that in that instance, the use of force, of deadly force, is justified. The law, though, doesn't necessarily represent what is, to quote a statement from Salt Lake City's new Commission on Racial Equity in Policing, what is truly right and just. And this week, you proposed some changes to the law on police use of force, and I want to talk about that. But before that, I'd like to just ask if that legal standard that is currently in place meant that your hands were tied and you absolutely couldn't charge these officers. And I think that in answering, you're going to have to talk about what a prosecutor, what a district attorney does. But Sim Gill, could you have charged these two officers?
There's two answers to that. The first, most simplest answer is, of course I can. I have the power to articulate information, a complaint, and I could charge you, Roger, right now, because that authority is there. Now, would that be unethical? Would that be malicious prosecution? Because I know that I don't have the evidence and I don't have the law on my side and I have no reasonable likelihood of success at trial and I'm going to be defeated, most likely even at a preliminary hearing because it is so factually and legally impossible. So I would be not only violating my ethical responsibility, my standards of filing a charge, but theoretically, ostensibly, you could say that I'm maliciously prosecuting you by ignoring all of that. And theoretically, you might be able to sue me for that abuse of authority that I have in light of everything that we have. Okay, so that's just a sort of a short answer. Could I charge? Of course I could. But the reason we didn't charge is also because, first of all, not only when the law says that if you're afraid for yourself or others, but if you also have somebody who is a person who's engaged in a violent felony that you have a probable cause to believe that they've committed a violent felony and they're trying to effectuate an escape to avoid arrest, that in the United States of America, the police, if they can articulate that, can shoot you in the leg, in the back, in the head, whatever. And that's cruel. It may sound cruel, but that is a public policy informed decision that the legislature has said that we're willing to authorize law enforcement officers to do. So in this scenario, it met all three different prongs of the use of force. Certainly, under the objective facts, they could articulate a fear for themselves. They could certainly articulate a fear for fellow officers. And they could articulate a fear for the community in the context of a allegation of a armed robbery. And then I now would say we were able to demonstrate that when the autopsy was done, at least one of the victims' wallet, identity, and money were found in the jacket of Palacio Carbajal. So under all of that, the law says that they are entitled legally to use lethal force. And then they're entitled to an affirmative defense of justification against subsequent prosecution.
Meaning, I guess the question that I would ask is, even with those changes of law that may be coming, and we can get to this, but was there any scenario under which you may have charged these officers? Because I think, Sim, that some people, especially those who have been protesting out there in the community, would say something along the lines of, even despite the fact that the letter of the law doesn't fit here and the charges wouldn't stick, you should charge him anyway because bringing those charges would help drive changes to the law itself, to say nothing of the sense of justice that they're seeking.
What the articulation of charges would have done is given us a single moment of euphoria and feeling good that we're holding somebody, charging them, and we're sort of publicly and institutionally holding them accountable, and they're not going to escape our judgment. But that momentary and temporary euphoria would have lasted as long as the first day in court when I had to go in a preliminary hearing, and it would have been thrown out. And then let's say I do the next case, and then the next case. All of a sudden, the narrative becomes that we are not enforcing the law, and the narrative becomes we can't, we're abusing the law and our institutional power, and then we move away from the systemic change that we want to make. The reason when I got elected, people take it for granted now, all the reports that I publish and write. When I got elected, my predecessors literally would say a sentence, if they actually reduced it to writing, to say it was justified, we screened it, there's nothing there. And in the year that we started to publish our reports, I gave a presentation at the National District Attorneys Association with about 400 elected other DAs from around the country. There was only about four or five of us, I think, at that time in the country who were doing it. And we did it with this purpose in mind. We did it in the purpose because our community deserves transparency. Our community, I had an obligation to bring the unvarnished truth, warts and all, and display it to our community. Where it was working, where it was not working, where they found it to be unsatisfactory to the consistent with the ideals that they wanted, and to arm them with the information for the systemic change that they want to make. And that also meant that we knew that that as the messenger that I was going to be attacked for that, and that's okay because the truth had a more compelling reason to be presented. But that means that if you're angry and you're upset, you certainly can go out in the street and protest, but that is only half of the conversation because the rest of the conversation for systemic, sustainable, long-term change is to change the law. And hence my statement, if we want different outcomes, then we must change the law to reflect the ideals that we want in this society. That's really where we needed to be.
If we want different outcomes, I mean, across the country, there are about 1,000 deaths at the hands of police every year. And some portion of those deaths are going to be when someone who is actually a criminal, and maybe a sizable portion of those deaths are going to be when somebody who is an actual criminal tries to resist. And another reality of America is that there are more guns, a lot more guns, in fact, than there are people in this country.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you can talk, Sim, about your understanding of the prevalence of police violence or of undue police violence in the country, because there are obviously, and you have tried to bring charges in instances in the past, but how big of a problem is it? What is your understanding of that? Can you talk about that?
So there's two ways to look at it. First of all, it is quite apparent that the criminal justice system as a whole and police intersections with our different communities is yielding outcomes or experiences that are not consistent with the expectations of what we would say are values and ideals as this society. There's a disconnect that's occurring there. And within the context of police work, you have to at least acknowledge it's dangerous work, and there are unfortunately bad people doing bad things to good people. And there is a necessity to respond to that. And I've said historically that majority of the time, I'm gonna most likely find these to be justified both under the existing law and also because the police officers are acting in the way that they were trained to act. But the integrity of a system is not by the 90 that I find justified, is the ability to identify that one or two that are unjustified and then meaningfully hold them accountable. And it's that second part of accountability that is also challenging. The historic challenge is lack of transparency because people don't feel part of the process and they feel unseen, unheard, and unresponded to. And then the lack of meaningful accountability because there are institutional barriers that stop it from happening. Now, that's one part of the equation. Now, there's a larger issue. Now, so let me share with you. I'm going to take a second here. I have a hypothesis. My hypothesis is that when public policymakers fail to address the issue of social justice, economic justice, political justice, jobs, education, public health. Those public policy failures manifest themselves in crisis in our community. And then our public policy makers look to law enforcement to be our crisis managers. And in application of that crisis management, it disproportionately impacts communities of color and poverty, not by accident, but by design. And it is really about political power. And so now, as a result of which, right now, this moment is an indictment of the criminal justice system and the indictment of police conduct, because that's the tip of the spear. Because when every avenue of institutional power has been shut off to you, and the only one that you're allowed to interact with is one of criminal justice, then you can understand why the 400 years of discrimination for African Americans, when they've never been part of our institutional reality in any way, they feel disconnected from that. But if we simply focus on this as the only thing, so certainly this is an indictment of our criminal justice system, an indictment of the police interaction, but it is fundamentally an indictment of our political system, our political failures. And that really is what this is about. And we should, and we can, and we must address the institutional issues with the criminal justice system. But when people talk about defunding the police, think about it. What are they talking about? They're talking about education, mental health, public health, livable and affordable housing, all those public policy failures that I pose in my hypothesis. And that really is what the reality is about. So the discontent in the street is about this larger issue. When you have an entire people who have never been given the equality of access to institutions, let alone the dignity of their personhood, then we see the social chaos that we find ourselves to, and we have to have that important conversation.
Sim, I think that some portion of the people listening, though, will say that, no, this is actually about this very specific single incident. And, you know, there are those, of course, as you pointed out, those one, those two, those 10%, whatever the percentage is, I don't know, where police use of force is not, again, to use the city's new racial equity and policing commission's language, where it's not right and just. And even in those instances, charges might not stick. And I'm thinking here of your determination that the shooting death of Danielle Willard back in 2013 was not justifiable under the law. That case fell apart, Sim. Was that because the letter of the law made it impossible to prosecute?
No, I think it also speaks to the broader systemic challenge that we have. Right? So, for example, we have competing interests between the civil interests for civil litigation of a municipality, because if the officers come and testify truthfully and what that might expose them to. So there's a conflict that is occurring because the municipality is trying to minimize its civil liability while I'm trying to decipher the truth and to hold somebody accountable.
This being West Valley City at the time, I guess.
Being West Valley City.
Yeah.
And then also that as a society, whether rightfully or wrongfully, there is a recognition that this is an inherently dangerous job, and we're willing to give a certain generous umbrella of protection for the work that is done as a value and as an ideal that we put in the law, and then educating judges. I mean, my judge dismissed it at the preliminary hearing and retired the next day. I asked the attorney general to say that under the low standards that we have, we should appeal this, and because I can't do my own appeals when it comes to that. So I couldn't even appeal it. So there are also structural institutional barriers. There are cultural barriers, as well as legal barriers to this issue of accountability. And the other thing is, the harsh reality also is, in a participatory democracy, while I may have voices that say this is not our ideal, if it, through the product of participatory democracy, we say, well, these are the ideals we're going to hold. That's why I say the conversation needs to go to the legislative level. And then we need to own our own decisions and our values and our own political failures and unable to change the law.
And being unable to change the law for some time now, I want to get to the changes that you recommend. And I just want to quickly mention that you and I, you know, we spoke back when the Willard case happened. And I remember that at the time, an attorney for the officers said that law enforcement definitely wasn't on the DA's side. You had a Salt Lake County Republican Party chairman calling you a cop hater.
I had protests. I've had protests, and they had a rally to denounce me.
Yeah. And now you're getting it from another side. With activists.
But that's okay. Yeah. Roger, that's okay. You know why? Because I am not here to advocate for the police, and I am not here to misapply the law. The space that I am willing to embrace and consciously do so is to be in that place to bring the truth to our community, to say, does this reflect? Here's the reality. My job is to chase the truth. Even if I have obstacles from law enforcement, it does not absolve me to try to put together what happened. And to share that with our community, say, this is our institution. This is what our laws are. These are the results. And if these don't comport with what you want, then let's do something about it.
So again, Utah law says that if an officer reasonably believes that a suspect will cause bodily harm or death to themselves, a fellow officer, or others, they can use deadly force. Holding off for just a moment, Sim, on your proposed changes to the law, and we're going to get there, I promise. Something that attorneys for the family of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal said during a press conference after your walkthrough of that shooting, those attorneys said that you could have, for example, brought excessive use of force charges against the officers. They said, you know, why did police officers need to shoot at him 34 times? Was that a charge that you could have brought but chose not to bring? And I guess, you know, why?
No. I would say very clearly no. Because first of all, the narrative out there before we did our investigation was that he was shot about 20, they fired 20 times. And I said, no, they fired 34 times. And of those 34 times, maybe 12 to 15 is the best that I could get from the ME that he was struck.
Medical examiner, yeah.
And then I also broke it down. There's a single event with two episodes. And the first episode is the initial decision when they fire, which is a burst of 6 to 8 shots that each officer fires. Then there's the continuity of the threat when Mr. Palacio Carbajal goes down, rolls over, points the gun in their direction, and they continue to abate the threat. Here's the other thing to keep in mind is that law enforcement officers are trained. This is how they're trained, and if we don't like it, change the law or change the training. They're trained, if the threat is presented, to abate the threat, okay? Again, not to make it too simplistic, but if the concern is to say we don't want officers to fire so many bullets, you could pass a law that says an officer can only have a gun that has 7 bullets in it. That means there'll be a lot more tactical reloads quickly that will happen, but you can do that. But the law and the training is, if the threat is legitimate and is presented, then we authorize you to use all and whatever necessary lethal force that you have to abate the threat as long as the threat is there. So now, for example, take a hypothetical. Suppose there's a person who is running away and they shoot, the gun goes flying off, he stumbles and falls down, and the officers walk up and fire at him gratuitously. That clearly would not be justified, right? Because that would be excessive force. But I could not temporarily tease out in the sequence of events that I had in this case to say there was such a clear break where the threat had abated and then they gratuitously went down and shot him, right? And so there's that continuity.
See, this is the thing, is I've never been in a situation, I've never had to be in a situation in which I've had to react in a way, you know, with a threat facing me like that. But of course, some people out there will say, well, if you shoot him once or you shoot him twice, you've basically abated the threat. But your determination in, again, this sequence of events you're describing is that he appeared to be conceivably still presenting a threat by going for the gun.
No, I concluded that he did present a threat. And the reason I know is that he fell forward. The gun was in his right hand. He rolled over. And he presented it twice when I zoomed in. And here's the final thing. The gun came to rest in his waist area on a prone body. That gun did not move there by itself. And then, so in order to put the gun there, I cannot refute that the officers say the gun was pointed at them and they perceived that as a threat. And so that's the challenge, you know, that we have. And that's why we delve into it so factually. Because each shooting is factually specific.
We won't be able to get through everything if we don't move along. And yeah. So, again, I'll point out that this week you said that you'd like to see or that you have recommendations for changing the law. There are 22 recommendations you're making, and we won't have time for all 22, but let's definitely tackle that reasonable belief standard. that if an officer reasonably believes that there's a danger, they can use deadly force. Instead of that, your change to the law would be they could use force if there was an imminent danger. Can you just explain this proposed change?
So the idea, so 2 points. One, the idea was that it was pretty clear to me between what the community of protesters want and what the they say what we are getting we don't like, and our policymakers who are like, well, what do we give to them? So I said, okay, you know what? I'm going to give you a series of proposals to start the conversation and what a blueprint might look like, whether you like them, dislike them, whatever, because I have no doubt the officers will train to the standards that you finally articulate. But here is a way to look at these challenges. So for example, we've proposed the idea of saying, even right now, one fundamental reality, even in 2020, there is not a national standard on the use of force. That's one thing. Okay. Second thing, while we talk and imply necessity, we've never described what necessity even means. So one of the things we propose is how to explain what necessary means. And what we say is, you know, that necessity means that there was no reasonable alternative to the use of deadly force. Okay. And so now you may not like that. So I'm open to it. We propose that, what about scenarios where the officer himself contributes to the exigency and then uses the exigency as the rationalization to use deadly force?
Sim, will you put that into more simpler terms? I mean, this is basically escalating. An officer escalates the situation, and then because he did that, he finds himself confronted with somebody against whom he can use deadly force.
Exigency means emergency, right? So I create the emergency, and then the emergency is my justification for the use of force. So I'll give you one very quick illustrative example. I took a very grim view on shooting at police cars early on. And because I would have a police officer who would step into the road, the car would be coming, but his stepping into the road, he says, now my life was in danger, so now I'm going to justify shooting at the car. So you created the exigency, and then you're using the exigency as your justification to use deadly force, right? So we've said, if you contribute in that way, or if you contributed in a criminally negligent way, then maybe the defense of justification shouldn't be available to you. Now, that's not a very complicated idea. It's a very common sense idea, but it also helps narrow that policing so those abuses can't occur.
That's okay.
You know?
Yeah. So there's one of your changes. I mean, you mentioned, what is this reasonable belief versus imminent danger? Can you describe that change?
Well, right now, I just have to have a reasonable belief that subjectively I'm in fear of that. And then I have to, and if there's anything objectively that may even support that, then I have to prove that your belief was unreasonable. And then I have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it was unreasonable, right? So we said, okay, well, what about situations like in normal, like citizens have defense, you know? Let's explore the idea of necessariness. Let's look at the imminence of it, and that I had no other choice because the threat was imminent to me, right? So we're trying to actually make it more easily defined and more clear in the definition, so we can say to the officers also, here's the standard, and in a clear way, and when whoever steps out of it does not get the benefit of the justification defense. We've even proposed the idea, for example, of an imperfect self-defense, where you subjectively feel that you're in fear for your life, but the objective reality doesn't necessarily support that. So in with a layman, you know, if you come down there and I go, I was afraid of Roger, which might be perfectly fine subjectively, and because I thought he was going to pull out a gun, so I shot him first before he could pull out a gun, but Roger didn't have a gun, then I don't charge you with the intentional killing, but I charge you with a lesser included of manslaughter, and it's called an imperfect self-defense.
Which doesn't exist right now as a category.
Which does not exist right now. And Professor Lee from George Washington University has written some quite eloquently about the idea of saying, by introducing the notion of imperfect self-defense, might also help us give further clarity to officers and then hold them accountable in situations where the factual reality does not support that, in a way, but there is still a jury that you can take it in front of the jury to decide whether that was reasonable or not.
So creating a new but lesser charge than, say, I don't know what it would be, murder, I guess.
From murder to manslaughter,
yeah,
in that particular narrow set of circumstances, right? And so that's just one of several things that we propose.
Well, you have another one that you propose, and I'll just bring it up, is the because I want to kind of guide us through this, is using less than lethal force if that's a reasonably available option, meaning, I guess, something like a taser or tackling the person or whatever. I mean, right? Is that correct?
Absolutely, because the question then becomes, part of the objective analysis is that if reasonably less lethal force was available to you and you went immediately to deadly or lethal force and under this fact scenario, that was the wrong choice, the failure to use less lethal force would preclude you from having the privilege of the justification defense. And again, these become nuanced, but they start to create a sense of what we expect our officers to do. And so we need to have a healthy debate about that.
You've described a kind of muscle memory that police have, you know, in these situations where they're still more likely to grab their firearm because that's the training that they have. And a change to the law might impel a different kind of training.
Yes, absolutely. And we also proposed in our recommendations for consideration and debate is issues such as, implicit bias training. We've also suggested what are called sentinel reviews, which are third-party entities that come in and help you do a debriefing on a shooting that an agency does, in a sort of a cocoon of protection, so you can have an honest discussion about it. So we said we need to do grandma protection, so it's not available for civil litigation, to protect the agency, but also to encourage a healthy, honest reevaluation by an unbiased third party to say, this is what you did right, this is what you did wrong, so they can, agencies and officers can learn from those issues. Because right now, there may be some debriefing that occurs, but not in the critical way that actually is constructive for future shootings, right? So these are the proposals that we're giving are proposals for transparency, for accountability that will have impact on training, as well as for criminal violations. We suggest, for example, the idea of third-party officers who see an officer escalating to a deadly force or excessive force, and they have a duty to intervene. Take, for example, the George Floyd matter, where you had those other officers who just stood by, who, if there was a duty to intervene, it would be part of their professional responsibility to go up to Chauvin, to the other officer who had his knee on there, to say, hang on a second, you need to take a breather, get up, we've got him, move back, because this is far too excessive. And failure to do so under the right circumstances could be criminally charged. And that would change the culture.
We're getting close to being out of time, and I'm going to post your full list of recommendations to the law along with this show. But, you know, these changes, they are changes that would have to be made by lawmakers, correct? I mean, and so do you think lawmakers will adopt any of these changes? What kind of pressure, what kind of pressure, Sim, will you exert on lawmakers to try and see that happen, or is that a role of yours or not, I guess?
Well, no, I think it is. I mean, we have already moved the needle, because first of all, lawmakers can't say, well, we didn't know where to start or what to look at. So these 22 recommendations is an invitation in a substantive way with an idea of a blueprint to start that critical conversation. The other thing that I'm happy to report, both from the Democratic and the Republican side of the House, we've had reach-in. There is a desire, and we've had people who've said, you know, I'm so glad that you did that, because now I have something to look at and to see how, where to approach on this. And some of these things are not very complicated, because, for example, one of the things I said is, give us in Utah, unlike other states, where prosecutors have that direct access to a grand jury, give me the ability and I'll even pay for it. Let me convene the grand jury as an investigatory tool in the issues that are involving officer-involved shootings. Let me have access to the grand jury, which is a community of peer of citizens, when we present these issues And so that to me would be a very beneficial tool as we talk about the independence of investigations.
And a relatively simple change there.
It's a simple change for which I'm willing to actually pay. So there's not even a fiscal note on it.
Of course, police and many police officers' unions, for example, will see any of these changes as an erosion of protections for the police, or some of them at least will see it that way, and will probably fight it tooth and nail. Doesn't that make it a very difficult change to make? I guess public pressure will have to be exerted.
Yeah, well, I think this is but that's the nature of participatory democracy. The other reason I'm saying this is that there are many good men and women in law enforcement who do their job with honor and distinction. And the clarity that we give to them, I genuinely believe this, some people may disagree with me. I genuinely believe that law enforcement may fight you and disagree with it, but ultimately they will rise to the standard that we set for them as a government, as our expression of our values. And the other part is, if we want to make no changes as a result of our participatory democracy, that in itself is also a statement of values and ideals. And what officers really need is the clarity, because I want them to exercise that within the law, so they know what they have to do. And then we as a society of community of citizens also know what our expectations are based on our role and responsibility as participants in this democratic process.
But there are, of course, those who are apathetic and who are frustrated by the fact that they're not seeing this participatory democracy working for them, and they're getting thwarted, and especially if you have this two-party system at each other's throats and demonizing each other right and left. I don't know, Sim.
You're touching upon my other part of which I said. This is not only an indictment of the criminal justice system. This is an indictment of our political process. And participatory democracy is hard work. It's not easy. And it is the byproduct of our political engagement. So for example, if we're out there suppressing the vote and we're gerrymandering, then we are not giving that political access. And that speaks to the larger issue of the inequity that we're trying to find a measure of justice for. The criminal justice system is just the manifestation of that policy failure. And that to me is the law. This is why this is so important. And so while I applaud and support, and I have participated in protests out in the street, but I am honestly, in the most honest way in doing my job, I'm not only informing my community, but I'm also saying to them, I can't do this by myself. And if we want different outcomes, then we need to change the law. And in order to achieve that, they have to take on their responsibility as citizens to help engage to effectuate that change. And that system may already have systemic flaws in it. And then that is the larger problem. And let's address that issue. But that is really the avenue that's available to us. Or the other alternative is we all just sort of throw up our hands and we say, well, the 200 plus year of experiment, it's not it. This is not the system that we want. And we want a brand new system. And there's a political process for that as well.
Sim, I know we need to let you go. I guess a final question that I have is, have these changes that you are recommending, have they been implemented anywhere else? And then are they also changes that you have recommended in the past and haven't seen go anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I've tried to. I mean, for example, the last two legislative sessions, I've gone up there on the Hill to have access to the grand jury, because I know police used to self-investigate. So we went up on the up to the state legislature a couple of years ago, and we helped draft a change in the law that says police can't self-investigate. And so we created the task force, so outside agencies have to come and investigate the shooting agency, and the DA gets to play a role in that. Do I think that needs to be a more independent investigator? So these are incremental changes that we've made. And to further support the independence of the investigation, after something has been presented to me, because sometimes I have officers who cooperate, sometimes officers who don't cooperate, but I have a duty to find the truth. And having the access to the grand jury will give me that access as an investigatory tool to get the truth. It would also give me a peers, members from the community, to sometimes evaluate whether charges should be filed or not. But that actually makes it more democratic in that sense.
But what have you gotten out of that?
So what we were able to achieve was that we were able to change the law, for example, to stop agencies from self-investigating. That was something that our office worked on. And the last couple of times we've had interest, but not support to give us access to the grand jury. But I think there's going to be support for that right now. So I'm hopeful that the necessity of this conversation and the blueprint that we've given will spark the debate. But at the end of the day, whether we get everything we want or don't want, we have to acknowledge that whatever that byproduct is the byproduct of our democracy at this moment, and then we own it.
I guess I'll wrap up with putting the words of someone else to you. I mean, there are, I think it was Black Lives Matter founder Lex Scott. I'm not positive. I read it in the press and I can't remember it now, but somebody out there whose criticism at this point to you is, you know, looking at your recommendations, this is too little too late, especially for victims of police shooting in the past. Do you want to reply to that?
In the most broadest general sense, that's a true statement. If it's directed specifically at me, I understand that. But I would also say, who in the last 10 years has been willing to put his chin out as an institution and personally burn through whether political capital or otherwise to advance the issue of criminal justice reform, to take on these hard questions and present the truth the way that it needs to be? There's nobody who's even attempted to prosecute police officers for their misconduct. We did. We found 7 to be unjustified, and we've called it like we see it. When officers deserve the protection based under the law, I'm very clear about that. When not, then I am also very clear about that. So we have led out on criminal justice reform. We have led out on this conversation knowing that educating and informing and sharing that information was going to spark criticism. And we welcome that criticism because it's healthy for our democratic process. Nobody else is doing it. One of the reasons I put these 22 proposals out is my question is, at this moment, I have policymakers waking up and saying, geez, we got to do something. My question is, where were you 2 years ago? Where were you 4 years ago, 6 years ago? George Floyd is not just the last person on this, unfortunately. There was also what? Tamir Rice, Breon Taylor, Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner. And so every 20 or 30 years, we have this issue because we're not willing to address the issue of racism, discrimination, the disproportional access to communities of color and poverty as policymakers. So my challenge to them is, who else is out here doing this? And where were my policymakers 6 years ago, 8 years ago? You didn't need to wait till George Floyd to have a voice to know that this injustice was going on. So are we going to go through another series of platitudes, another set of committee hearings and listening tours, and then anecdotal, incremental sort of things, and then we pat ourselves on the back? Or are we willing to have the honest conversation, the difficult conversation, to say this is much broader? So that's the work that I'm committed to. And if being a messenger of that harsh truth is discomfortable and uncomfortable to some, then my question is, what are you going to do about it as a part of this democracy? Because I'm trying to do my part. And I'm not saying I've done everything or I've done it completely, but with the opportunity that I've been given within the oath that I've taken and the ethical bounds that I have, I've done everything in my power. And I'm the first one to admit I can't do it by myself. So I'm looking to my community to support this.
Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, thanks for making time for this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for the privilege.
You've been listening to In the Hive here on KCPW. Find podcasts at our website or however you get them. That does it for the show. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again next week.